So, we had a lot of readings about vineyards this morning. And part of that is because Israel's poets and prophets often referred to the people as a vineyard, a planting of God. It was a metaphor that suggested God's care and tending, but also God's call to them to be fruitful, to be a blessing to each other, to their neighbors, and ultimately to the whole world. A calling to live into God's peace, or shalom, which would flow from practices of love, humility, justice, and mercy. The passage we read in Isaiah functions like a parable in which God is portrayed as setting a vineyard upon a fertile hill and clearing the land of stones. God creates a watchtower to look out for animals that might threaten the vines and hews out a wine vat, anticipating its fruit. But in this parable, the planter is astonished by the wild grapes that grow, a fruit that will set the teeth on edge. And so the prophet announces God's intention to remove the protective hedges and walls, to abandon the pruning, even to withhold rain, allowing the vineyard to be devoured, trampled, and overgrown with briars. The passage we read ends with this interesting wordplay that we don't get because we don't read Hebrew. It says, God expected justice, but saw bloodshed. And the Hebrew words for justice and bloodshed are spelled very similarly, with just a change in the vowel. Also says that God expected righteousness, but heard a cry. And the word for righteousness and the word for a loud scream of torment are very similar. So there's wordplay, word association happening. Bloodshed and anguished screams of the poor constitute the wild fruit of a vineyard planted, but planted in love and hope. So this is a parable of judgment, of accusation against a nation that was riddled at the time with corruption, exploitation of the poor, abandonment of the widow, the orphan, and the alien, and a preoccupation with war. The psalm that we read is the voice of that vineyard in the midst of its experience of broken walls and ravaged vines. The writer pleads with God to once again behold and tend to the vine, preserving what God's own hand had planted. Isaiah had warned of the coming exile of the kingdom of Judah. And this psalm appears to be written sometime after that exile had become a reality. The psalm ends with a hopeful appeal, anticipating a time of restoration. Even while preaching that Israel's abandonment of God would result in being ravaged by rival kingdoms, the prophet Isaiah also prophesied of God's intent to redeem and restore Israel, and through Israel, the wider world. And so the larger prophecy of Isaiah blends judgment with grace. There will be a season of intense hardship as Judah experiences the natural results of a standard of living that it had chosen in direct opposition to what it had been called to pursue. Instead of justice, bloodshed. Instead of righteousness, the cry of the poor. But that season, Isaiah says, will be followed by a grace that will overwhelm. They'll bring redemption and restoration, ushering in greater peace than known before. Now, the book of Isaiah seems to be one that Jesus himself was fond of quoting. And when Jesus is confronted by the temple authorities in today's gospel, he decides to tell a parable that would have brought to mind this passage from Isaiah and the many times in which the people were portrayed as a vineyard planted by God. But Jesus is also using a tactic that the prophet Nathan used when confronting King David with his adultery and murder of Bathsheba's husband. Nathan came to him and told a story about someone who had abused his neighbor and asked King David what should be done to the perpetrator. And King David came down hard on his desire for justice. But the story was a trap. And Nathan reveals that David is himself the one who has acted like the person in the story. And David did face consequences, but he also received more grace than he would have given himself. So Jesus tells a story about a vineyard, but this time it is not the vines that are the problem. Jesus introduces a caste of tenant farmers who are perpetrators of violence. In this parable, the people are the vineyard, but the tenant farmers are the temple authorities, and he implies that they had been entrusted to care for and tend to the vineyard. But when the time for harvest came, they turned on the owner of the vineyard and anyone who came on the owner's behalf. The initial servants sent out to collect the harvest represent the early prophets, and the second set of servants, the later prophets. And then, of course, the owner sends his own son. And one of the things that strikes me in this story is the apparent absurdity of the owner thinking that his son would be treated with respect after the beating, stoning, and killing of previous messengers. But this is what the Apostle Paul talks about when saying that the wisdom of God appears as foolishness in the eyes of the world. For reasons that may not make sense, God chose to encounter the world's violence with God's own body. Yet, in the parable, the Son is sent with hope. Hope that the tenants might finally recognize the grace they were being offered. But they do not. Like King David, the temple authorities were asked by the storyteller what would happen to the tenants, and they spoke what seemed reasonable to them. He will put those wretches to a miserable death and lease the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the produce at the harvest time. At this point, they do not recognize themselves in the story. And they are working from their own mindset of crime and punishment, of an authority who will come to settle the score. And their response actually reveals one of the major problems they have with Jesus. Jesus claims to be the Messiah, but he doesn't seem to be settling any scores or holding sinners' feet to the fire. Jesus is instead lingering at the table with tax collectors and loose women and other people who fall short of the standards of living that the temple authorities were always reminding people to take seriously. They expect a system of reward and punishment based on moral performance. But Jesus knew that none of us were ever going to come out with all A's on a morality report card. And so Jesus put grace at the center and did away with the performance game. All he required was trust in a route to redemption that involved his own suffering, death, and resurrection. The disappointment with this aspect of Jesus, the disappointment held by the religious authorities, is alive and well today. In a recent interview with NPR, Russell Moore, the editor-in-chief of Christianity Today, shared why he has come to see Christianity as existing in a time of crisis. He said, "It was the result of having multiple pastors tell me essentially the same story about quoting the Sermon on the Mount, 'Turn the other cheek,' and to have someone come up after to say, 'Where did you get those liberal talking points?' And what was alarming to me was that in most of these scenarios, when the pastor would say, 'I'm literally quoting Jesus Christ,' the response would not be, 'Oh, I apologize.' The response would be, 'Yes, but that doesn't work anymore. That's weak.'" Now, I've just quoted a conservative Christian critiquing evangelical Christians, but I think you can find a similar spirit among some of those of us who consider ourselves progressive. I have to do regular battle internally with my own discomfort with grace. My own discomfort with God not making moral performance a requirement for whom God loves and redeems. That is part of our work to do as we take up residence in the kingdom of heaven, to keep embracing the inside-out logic of grace and all the people it welcomes. When the temple authorities pronounce a judgment of miserable death upon the tenants, Jesus doesn't say, "That's right, they gotta die." Instead, he points them to Psalm 118 and talks about a stone rejected by builders that becomes the essential cornerstone of a new architecture. He tells them that the kingdom, this joyful fellowship of believers set free, will be taken from them, not on the basis of some failing grade in ethics class, but because they have chosen to be outside that circle of welcome. They have chosen instead to rely on a scheme for achieving moral excellence rather than trusting him, being shaped by him, entering a life marked by, "I'm sorry, and I will learn, and I will lean into the new thing you are showing me how to do." Rather than following him into a kingdom built on grace and on his own death and resurrection, they have cherished the belief that they deserve some form of distinction and power over the messy masses around them. The temple authorities eventually realized they were being called out, and they wanted so badly to arrest Jesus. So they went looking for an opportunity to drag him down. And it would come just a few days later when Judas betrayed him. In their arrest and insistence upon his death, they would show that they still didn't get it. And even then, Jesus was taking their worst and converting it into the architecture of redemption. I'm not saying that God has stopped caring about things like justice and righteousness. I just think that God knows that we don't know how to get to those things on our own. And so God has created a path for us. It is through trusting Jesus that we are grafted into the true vine, the vine through whom the practices of love, humility, justice and mercy flow into us and become the fruit of the kingdom we were born to bear. The fruit of the kingdom, it turns out, comes from yielding, not from striving.